Good afternoon. It's certainly good to see a group of this number out for an occasion like this on a Saturday afternoon. I know there are a lot of other things that can compete for your time and your choice to be with us this afternoon. I appreciate, and hopefully this will be something worth your while in our discussion. The session coming up immediately, I'm going to be talking about Abraham. And then the next session at 2, we will be talking about Hezekiah, two Old Testament personalities, of course. And to a large extent, the emphasis of both the lessons is the same. The emphasis has to do with the faith of these individuals in the face of their adversity and conflict. So we'll get into the discussion. Hope everybody can see this okay. Father Abraham, I'm not suggesting he is a religious leader in the sense that the term father is used. Actually, this is a play off the song that people sing at VBS stuff, and I'm not going to have you sing it. Father Abraham had 7 sons. I'm not going to do that. Frankly, that song always annoyed me, but anyway. I know people are familiar with it. But the title of there's a chapter in the book entitled, Abraham, What Did You See? And that's actually a better description of what's going on here, because what I want us to do is to look at the land of Canaan as it was when Abraham comes into the country. Now, the reason this is some significance, and I'll admit that it was my lack of familiarity with this before I got into my archaeological studies, to realize how urbanized was the land of Canaan when Abraham arrives. Now, when I talk about urbanized, please don't transmit that to our kind of urbanization that we think in terms of. But most of us, when we read the narrative of Genesis and the life of Abraham, have a tendency to think of him simply wandering around out in the wild with his sheep and his goats and rarely encountering anybody that lives in a town. And while that certainly is the case as far as the narrative of the Bible presents this, what we often overlook, simply because of our ignorance, is not an error on the Bible's part, but because of our ignorance, is there were a lot of towns that dotted the landscape that Abraham would be very familiar with. And I want us to look at some of the dynamics. The land of Canaan was very militarized, was very well fortified. There was a lot of social and political unrest in the land of Canaan, and it's into that world that Abraham comes. And then I want us to reflect upon some implications of that. But we start with Abraham's call from Ur of the Chaldees when the Lord comes and summons him to leave his family, along with some of his family, to go to the land that he would show them. And they leave Ur of the Chaldees. This is the Ziggurat of Ur. This is its condition. After some initial excavation, this is sort of a restored element, a reconstructed component. I don't know exactly when this photograph was taken. I've never been here. But that 1956 Buick, I'm not sure is contemporary, the latest model of vehicle that could be used. But I would love to be able to see this. I understand it has suffered a good bit in the course of the current political turmoil and so forth. But the Ziggurat of Ur is a worship shrine of some kind. It is usually thought to be a temple platform on top of which there was a temple by which the priests of the area sought to get in touch with the divine. But it's from this context that God summons Abram and the family, Zerah and the rest of the family, to come and go to another location. Now, there's an argument as to when exactly Abraham lived, but I'm inclined to think that he lived slightly before the time of Hammurabi. Now, if you're familiar from your world history class, some of you might have preferred not to remember your world history classes and so forth, but Hammurabi is considered one of those great figures of secular history. He's often argued to be the first one who codified law. We now know that that is not the case. It is certainly the longest codification of law that we have, but it's not the earliest that we have available. But that's really not important for our purposes here. But the Code of Hammurabi, at the top of it, the stela stands about 7.5 feet tall. And it's made out of very highly polished black diorite stone. It's really quite a pretty artifact from the standpoint of its construction. And it has written all over it in cuneiform, in Akkadian, various laws. If something happens, then this is what you do. Most of it's what we call casuistic law or case law that addresses circumstances that develop. And the book of Deuteronomy has quite a number of those kinds of case law presentations. But right at the top, about a foot of the top of this stela, has this carving carved into the stone. And in this, what we have portrayed are two individuals, obviously. One is Shamash, who is the god of justice and the god of light. And standing before him is Hammurabi. Now, as you look at the portrayal of Shamash, he's sitting on his throne, and of course, Hammurabi is standing in front of him and this sort of paying homage to him. This is sort of the typical kind of approach, unless they're just downright bowing. But obviously, Hammurabi is not bowing down. Now, as you look at Shamash, you'll see these little wiggle lines coming out of his shoulders. Okay, those are supposed to represent the rays of the sun radiating from his being. He's the sun god. And one of the reasons he is the sun god that is associated with justice is exactly the same kind of fairly universal perspective of light that characterizes most cultures. Light is that which brings to awareness the wrong that has been done. And the tendency for people to do wickedness and corruption in the dark, they hide it in the dark, and they don't want the light to manifest their wrongdoing. The New Testament, of course, will talk in this fashion. The Old Testament will talk in this fashion. I'm not suggesting the New Testament and the Old Testament are borrowing this from anybody, but this is just a very common kind of perception that humanity had. But in this portrayal, Shamash is handing over the representation of the law to Hammurabi. And this is indicative of the lawful character that is supposed to govern humanity. Now, having said that, all of us are fully aware of the fact that people aren't really very good at following the rules. That's one reason why you have to have the rules, is because of the tendency of human beings to want to rebel. Now, most of the people do follow the rules fairly well. So to a large extent, many times the rules are made up for that minority that refuses to follow them. But this is the kind of situation that is going on in Mesopotamia. We do not know how law-abiding they were, but certainly this is a portrayal of some element of justice. And it's out of this context and the fact that, the fact that this law code is so extensive implies that to a large extent, these laws were already around, and people were familiar with them even as early as the time of Abraham, and we now know from other excavations even earlier. But God calls Abram and this family from Ur of the Chaldees, which is situated at the southern end of Mesopotamia, and they travel up to, Haran, where they stop and stay for a few years, and finally the Lord comes to Abram specifically, and says, I want you to leave your family and your kindred and go to a place that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse. And so Abraham packs up all of his goods, along with his nephew Lot, who is going to be his heir, and they take all of their goods and leave for an area where Abraham does not know where he's going. He's 75 years old, venturing off on this adventure to an area that is totally unknown to him. Now, most 75-year-old folks aren't that quite that ambitious. To leave all the family behind, to leave all of the known connections behind, to go to a new land they don't know anything about and they don't know anybody that lives there. To the contrary, most of the time, if any 75-year-olds are moving, it's to where the kids are. But Abraham is in a reversal here. And part of this reflects the faith that he has in God to protect him and care for him and guide him. So he finally comes, and the Bible narrates his initial stop of any duration, and we don't know how long he stays there, is at Shechem. And there he builds an altar to the Lord, but then he moves on down between Bethel and Ai and sets up his tent, and he begins to live down near Bethel and Ai. But his first narration of a stop of any significance is at Shechem. And so you're looking at a trip that involves several hundred miles in order to make this, almost 1,000 miles, if not slightly more. And to consider that he's traveling with a large herd of animals going ultimately from Ur to Haran down to Shechem, it would take a long time to make this trip because you can't drive the animals too fast at too much of a pace. But he's coming to a new land. And now the question is, what is this land like? What does he see as he arrives here? Well, here's a picture that, again, I mentioned, alluded to this last night. Sharon and I, in 2007, spent 7 months, or not 3 weeks. 7 months, I don't know where the 7 months. It was in 2007 that we spent 3 weeks in Israel traveling around. And this was in March, February and March. And so you see the green hue on the fields. Obviously, this does not grow really lush kind of vegetation, but it's sufficient for the flocks to graze on. And it's easy to imagine this sort of being the kind of scene that Abraham is traveling around with Lot and the family and so forth, grazing the animals. Now, you see over there in the distance, there are some houses. Well, that's the kind of thing I want you to think in terms of, that while Abraham certainly is living away from the towns, there are towns dotted around all over the place, far more extensively than we normally think in terms of. Remember that episode where Abram is sitting in the heat of the day and the three beings are coming toward him and he's going to entertain them and he's going to be apprised of the destruction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar, and the Lord points out he's going to go down there and investigate all of this. It may be a scene like this. Imagine there's a tent underneath this, and Abram sitting there, and he sees off in the horizon looking across the way, and the heat waves rising up from the soil, and you know that wiggle effect that takes place as he's watching them finally come into focus, and he extends his hospitality. Imagine a scene similar to this as being that which is going on in that narration. It's really fascinating to sort of begin to put yourself in these kind of contexts. But again, while Abram is a shepherd, shepherding his flocks, it is important that we not assume that this land of Canaan is devoid of all occupation. Now here's a photograph of some Bedouin tents. The Bedouin loved to live in these tents. I remember when I first went to Israel back in the 70s, I would see all these Bedouin tents scattered around and think, my, these poor people that live in these tents. And then as we would drive along, I happened to notice almost every one of them had one or two Mercedes-Benz parked outside. And I'm fully aware of the fact that most of the time, certainly there are exceptions, most of the time the Bedouin want to live in these tents. Now, some of these tents are really luxurious, but they want to be able to live in the tents and take up stakes and move to another location, and the Israelis don't like that, because it means it's more difficult for them to keep tabs on the Bedouin and what the Bedouin are doing. And that's part of the reason why the Bedouin prefer to live in the tents, so the Israelis can't keep track of them very well. And, you know, it's modern politics all over again. But it's easy to imagine Abraham's abode looking something like that. Now, to set the scene, this is actually a painting from Egypt in what is known as Beni Hassan tomb painting. And this is an artist reproduction that sort of refines it a little bit, makes it look a little fresher and more vibrant. But a couple of things I want to point out here. First, this is what is a wraparound. This is the front of the painting. Obviously, everybody's looking off to the right. And the donkey nose should be actually right over there at the end of that. So I've wrapped this around, so you have to sort of use your mind to bend it all into one line. Okay, you follow me? So this register is actually a continuation of that one. But we've split it in order to enlarge it, in order to make it show up better on the screen. The Egyptians are the two individuals that are in white. All the rest of the folks here are Canaanites that are going down into the land of Egypt to visit and to carry on business. The date of this painting is about 1990 BC. It would be about the time of Abraham or so. And if you recall the narrative in Genesis chapter 12, whenever Abram is called from his homeland, even at the end of chapter 12, he immediately has to go to Egypt because there's a famine in the land. So it's sort of easy to imagine, if you will, that maybe Abram's departure into the land of Egypt because of that famine could look something like this. We do know from the literature of Egypt that there is a good bit of interaction and travel between Canaan and Egypt, and this, of course, portrays that. The hieroglyphics up here at the top talk about a man who has Abu Ashi or something like that. Abshi is his name. Abshi, who's coming down with 37 of Asiatics or Hyksos, who are traveling down into the land of Egypt. And they're going to be selling coal. Now, coal is not C-O-A-L. It's not the black stone that we use to fuel things. It's spelled K-O-H-L, but it has nothing to do with department stores. Do you all have coal department stores out here? All right. I'm not sure. Okay. It has nothing to do with that either. But the coal is the black stuff that the Egyptians and people would often put as sort of the eye shadow that serves to reduce the glare of the sun as well as to help keep flies away from your eyes. So that's one of the things that they're marketing. But in addition, there are also these little weird-looking things that you have on the back of the donkey here and the back of the donkey there are bellows that would be used to oxygenate a fire to intensify its heat so they could work in copper and bronze. So they're itinerant metal workers and they're itinerant marketers of coal. Now, what I want you to know beyond that, though, and notice are all of the military representations, the spears and the bows and arrows and the axes and the throwing sticks. These are throwing sticks and so forth. This is an axe. We'll come back to it later. This is a lyre that the individual is carrying. But obviously there's a bow and a quiver and a spear, and here's a little boy with his, I don't know that I want to call it a toy spear, but a little boy with his spear that he's carrying along, sort of being like dad, you know. I vividly remember that kind of thing when I was a youngster. And then the bows that they're carrying, the spears that they're carrying. Now, obviously, if they're traveling out in the wild, it's certainly reasonable and understandable that they would have these kind of weapons in case they would be attacked. But what we're going to begin to find is that Canaan was viewed by the Egyptians as very militarized. Now, that does not mean Egypt isn't, but they're afraid of the Canaanites. And they think the Canaanites, and they're afraid the Canaanites are going to overpower them. And we'll look at some evidence of that in a moment. So I want you to tuck that away into this network that we're going to be painting here. Now we come back to the land of Canaan, and I want to show you fairly rapidly a series of fortification systems. This is at the site of Shechem. Remember, this is the first location where Abraham is described as stopping in Genesis chapter 12. Toward the end of the chapter. And this is what is referred to as a Migdal temple. Now the word Migdal means fortress. Now to give you some idea of why we call it a fortress temple, and by the way, this is not necessarily a term that we have appropriated for. It's not like Bilbil yesterday. This is a term that would have been used in the ancient world to refer to these various locations. But notice how thick the walls are. And while you might not be able to get some inference as to how big the walls are, look at the size of the cars down here. And use that as sort of a scale to think in terms, that wall is as thick as the length of that car. And this is not one of those little tiny smart cars that is now on the market here in this country. This would be something like, I'm renting a Hyundai Tucson out there. This is about the size of that. So we're looking at 15 to 20 foot thick walls. Why do you need 15 to 20 thick walls? Well, it's a fortress. And the idea is that people would retreat in here in time of siege. But you also have this fortification system that rings the town itself. So this is sort of a last resort into which they would go. Now, these temples often would be repositories for precious metals and so forth, which is another reason why you would have the significant fortification component to try and protect the wealth. And so this is the kind of thing that Abraham begins to see. This is a top plan drawing of that fortress temple that we were looking at there. And this is a series of similar kind of temples that are at the site of Megiddo. Now what happened in this situation, this is the oldest one on the left-hand side. This is the next one that was built on top of that, and it was destroyed. And then they built this one on top of that one, and it was destroyed. So there's a religious aura that is perceived to exist in these temple areas. And so when one's torn down, they would build another temple on top of it, trying to sort of appropriate the holiness of the site into the new structure. But at the same time, you have the same kind of very, very thick walls and the construction involved. I'm looking for the scale on this. Here's the scale. From there to there is 15 feet. And so we're looking at thick walls that are something like 12 feet thick, characterizing that one of these temples. Now, the walls here are a little thinner. But again, you have this impression of a fortress kind of structure. At the side of Gezer, and I'm going to show you where some of these places are in a moment, at the side of Gezer, there is the series of standing stones that are thought by anthropologists to be representative of sort of a coalition of cities that have vowed allegiance to one another, that if one of them is attacked, then the others will band together in a mutual defense of that attacked town. Sort of a NATO pact, if you will. Again, things have not changed much. Countries still will have these kind of alliances and so forth, and the people in the ancient world had the same thing. This is about the same time as Abraham. Now, the Bible tells us specifically in Genesis chapter 14 that when Lot and his family are kidnapped and taken away as captives by the kings from Mesopotamia, Abraham musters a force out of his household that numbers 318 men born in his house that are trained in military strategies. Now, that speaks volumes. One, it tells you something how big sort of a sheikh he is in this family. He's the head of the family, and there are 318 men trained in military abilities, born in his household. Now, why would he need 318 men to defend himself if it doesn't say something about the perception of the military unrest of the region? Things haven't changed much. But this speaks volumes. But in that narrative, in Genesis chapter 14, Abraham is taking this band of 318 along with some others that are allies with him, and they go to the side of Dan. Now, the excavations at Dan have uncovered this mud brick arched gateway into the city as part of the fortification. It's tantalizing, and the Bible specifically refers to Dan. It's tantalizing to wonder, did Abraham see this? I don't know whether he did or not. The Bible doesn't say anything about him seeing the fortifications of Dan, but if these were not already buried or had not yet been constructed, it's easy to infer that he very likely would have seen this. This is a model of what the art historians and military strategists think the gate ultimately looked like, with walls surmounting the top of this that probably extended above the gate crenellations and so forth. Another Middle Bronze Age site, Hazor, which I talked about yesterday with the sewer pipes, this area is the old city during the time of Abraham, and this moat on the west side that extends around to the north side was dug, and they dug the soil out and then piled it up over here to make about a 60 to 70 foot variation, as you would have to go down into the ditch in order to climb up the other side and over the next one to get into the interior of the town. And this would give you a good bit of opportunity to defend yourself. Now, things are sort of eroded here. 3,000 years, 4,000 years have elapsed since all of this was built, and so you can imagine it being more crisp looking and sharp in regards to trying to negotiate this. But this is an aerial view of part of the fortification system at Hazor. Going back to the side of Gezer, this is a corner tower of a fortification defensive strategy. I'm standing there, I realize I'm not the best of scales, but it still gives you some chance to see how big that is, and the manpower that would be demanded to construct this. Now, if all of this doesn't imply something about perceived or real military threats in the region, I don't know what the purpose of all of this is. Continuing the discussion here, this is the gateway. There's the drawing of the gate, and now it's all sort of filled in with a lot of rubble, but this is the passageway that you have available. And then there is this glacis that we have that fronts that gate. It would be out here on the lower left photograph over here. It would be outside that gate and along the walls, and this slope of about 45 degrees. This is the construction part. This is the debris that's accumulated over time. But I trust you can see that very straight line that runs down diagonally across here. Can you see that? That is a line of plaster that is there in order to make it slick and difficult for an attacking army to climb up that. And then in time of warfare, they would pour oil over that and make it slicker and compound the difficulty for the attackers to make any access. These glossae are fairly common. Here is one at Jericho. Here is a city gate at Ashkelon. And then part of the glossae at Ashkelon, that city gate that we were looking at, which is now in this photograph, is off to the left from this larger glossae that we're looking at. But again, this was originally coated with a layer of plaster. The plaster has eroded away through time. And trying to climb up this and clamber up the side in order to get into the city would have been extremely challenging. Now, this is an aerial view of the city gate at Beth Shemesh, where I am the field director. This is the entrance into the gate area in the city. And you can see two people who are here that serve sort of as scales to give some element of how big this gate is. These are not tiny little just doorways that you open up the door and let people in and then close it. There's a lot of planning that goes into this, a lot of implied fear that is indicated. The city fortification itself, the wall extending from the city gate, is about 8 feet. These are not really huge, but these are about 8 feet thick here. And these are not as large as some of the other walls that we've seen, but nonetheless, I would not really want to have to fool with breaking down an 8 foot thick stone wall. And of course, that's inevitably the challenge. Now the dots that I show here show some of the sites, and I emphasize the word some of the sites with fortification remains from the time of the patriarchs. Gezer is situated right there. Actually, Gezer is there. Beth Shemesh is there that I was showing you. Hazor is up here. Shechem is here. Now, to put this into perspective, this is Dan. That's where the mud brick city gate that we talked about a moment ago. There's Dan. And Beersheba is down here. And the reason I point out from Dan to Beersheba is the Bible will talk about from Dan to Beersheba as sort of the primary geographic range of ancient Israel. All right? The distance from Dan to Beersheba is about 150 miles. Now, that's not very far. I mean, you and I can negotiate 150 miles on a freeway easily within 2 hours. Or in about 2 hours. In the ancient world, people obviously had to take a lot longer to make the trip. But what I want you to recognize is that if you look at and think in terms of from Dan to Beersheba as 150 miles, about every 15 miles or so, you're looking at a fortified site. This is the world into which Abraham comes. And I've often wondered since I became aware of all of this, what did Abraham think about all of this? Now, I want to put that question on hold. We'll come back to it. We're not done with how militarized the world was of Abraham's time. I mentioned a moment ago the fear that the Egyptians had of the Canaanites. One of the manifestations of that have to do with these execration texts. There are two of them. There are actually quite a number of these, but photographs of two of them. And these would be often made in the form of dolls with handwriting on them. And the handwriting would be basically declarations of cursed be the king of Akshaph, and cursed be the king of Megiddo, and cursed be the king of Hebron, and cursed be the king of Shechem, and so forth and so on. And they would have all these curses on it. And then they would break the doll in order to implement the curse, sort of a voodoo kind of thing. Well, the fact that they're cursing all of these towns implies that they have a fear of the Canaanites and the military might that otherwise is developing there. And remember that painting of the Beni Hassan tomb with all of the armaments that the individuals had. Remember also the implied element of Abraham having 318 military individuals born in his household. If this is a peaceful environment, why do you need so many people who are trained in military? I think these are legitimate questions to ask. And then you look at all of the dots of fortification systems that would be very, very difficult to overcome. Another evidence of the perceived problems that Egypt has with Canaan has to do with what is known as the story of Sinuhe, which dates to the mid-20th century BC, where there is an Egyptian military leader who flees to the land of Canaan, and he hires himself out to a Bedouin sheikh, for lack of a better term, as a military advisor and trainer. By the way, the description of the land of Canaan is remarkably similar to that which the Bible describes, as a land flowing with milk and honey and all of that kind of thing. But Sinuhe goes to the land of Canaan and he hires himself out and becomes the leader of a military element. Now, if you've ever watched the movie Lawrence of Arabia and remember all of those tribal kind of confederations, that's the kind of thing you probably need to think in terms of here. And this is the way Canaan was perceived. But there are also some technological advances that are beginning. At about 2000 BC, technology has moved from purely copper and stone weaponry to bronze. Bronze is a much more durable and effective weapon mode than is copper. Copper bends way too easily. It loses its edge. It's fairly easy to work, partly because it's relatively soft. But if you put 5 to 10%, ideally 5 to 8% tin in the copper, it makes it a much more hard and durable weapon. And they began to develop the technology. Here is a mold that was found at Shechem to make bronze blades and axes. Here is an example of a bronze axe, and it's only about this long. It's only about 7 or 8 inches long and about an inch thick as far as the height from here to here. And it's pretty clear this is not designed for being used as chopping down trees. These are used as weapons, as sort of what we would call hatchets or tomahawk kind of thing. Sometimes perhaps throwing them, but primarily used for hitting people and cracking skulls and breaking bones and inflicting injuries upon others. They're weapons in the very real sense of the term. Another kind of axe that was developed, this is an early Bronze Age period axe made out of copper, but these two are bronze, and these are real bronze, and we refer to them as duck-billed axes. I don't think the people of the ancient world referred to them as duck-billed axes, but I think you can see why we refer to them as duck-billed. I don't think it has anything to do with Duck Dynasty, in case you're gravitating in that direction. But these also are quite small. That one is about this thick as far as its height, and it's about 6 inches long. And again, these have a good bit of heft to them, but they're designed primarily to crack skulls and inflict bodily injury. Now, as we think in terms of that, if you look back at the Beni Hassan tomb, that actually in the real painting is one of these. The real painting actually has the two holes represented, but for whatever reason, the artist that copied this neglected or refused to put the representation of the two little holes. But this gives us a time frame for the typology of this axe, and it puts it into the time frame roughly of the patriarchs. One of the things the Bible tells us is that Abraham did not really own much in the way of property. God tells him, "Go to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation." The only property the Bible ever describes that Abraham owns were a couple of wells that became points of dispute between him and Abimelech, and then a tomb that he buys. And this is a picture of a tomb from the Middle Bronze Age, down from around Jericho. I'm not at all arguing this is Abraham's tomb. That's not my point. But the tomb is interesting from a couple of standpoints, and we'll talk more about some of this tomorrow morning at our worship hour. I realize that's bizarre, but we're going to talk about some tombs at worship hour tomorrow morning. But in this, you see the skeleton laid out on this platform. And that platform represents sort of a bed. And the individual would be placed there and left there to decay. Now, if you look carefully in this, you'll see around the perimeter of the room skulls that are scattered around, in indicating that there are quite a number of other individuals that were interred in this tomb as well. This is a family burial plot. Now, we don't know the mechanics specifically of how Abraham's family is buried, but the Bible does tell us that he buys the cave of Machpelah where he's going to bury his wife. And eventually, Isaac and Rebekah will be buried in that same cave. And then eventually, Jacob and Leah will be buried in that same cave, along with Abraham and his wife. Now, how many other individuals are going to be buried in that cave, we don't know, because the Bible doesn't give us specific numbers, but we know of six individuals that were buried in the cave of Machpelah, according to the biblical text. Whether it looked like this or not, I'm not going to affirm, but the probability is pretty good. One of the things that the people in the ancient world were concerned about was being buried at the family burial plot. And a lot of people today are concerned with that. When they pass away, they want their remains to be taken back to the family burial plot in order to reside at that location. How much that plays into this is not clear, except for the Bible does talk about, and he was gathered to his fathers, or he slept with the fathers, and so forth. And slept here is not used in the same sense of the people today. We'll throw that word around. All right. So, it's tantalizing to think in terms of what is Abraham thinking as he goes through all of this. But here's the summary. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. The question I want to come back to again is, I wonder what Abraham thought. God has promised me, Abraham thinking here, God has promised me to give me and my descendants this land. And yet, as I travel through this land, look at how military armed it is. Look at how well fortified it is. And yet, the Bible gives no indication whatsoever of him lifting a finger overtly to take any land from the people. The only military engagement that we have any specific statement about is his rescuing his nephew who has been captured. But clearly Abraham has some concern about safety and protection, as implied in the 318 people in his own household. Clearly, I think we need to infer that by faith, Abraham is functioning. Logistically, if he thinks through this at all, he will recognize that he would never live long enough to see his descendants accommodate all of this land. He's 75 when he's first summoned. He's 100 when he has the child of promise. And there's no way he's going to live long enough to see Isaac and all of the descendants come into a great nation. But he's still operating on the basis of the faith of what God had promised. And sometimes that's simply the way we have to live. God promises us wonderful, grand things. But how many times do we try to sort of push the promise in a premature way because we think it ought to be different? Well, we don't have any evidence of Abraham doing that. We need to let God operate in his own time, but we certainly need to be companions with him in following his will and submitting to the will that he to the law that he has provided for us. May we, like Abraham, have a faith that recognizes God will follow through with what he's promised in his own time. I thank you for your time, and Brother Bruce.